television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Matt McLennan. Matt McLennan is a writer and producer who, over the past few years, has worked on some of Canada's most popular homegrown shows, including Rookie Blue, Played, Call Me Fitz, The Listener, Republic of Doyle, Degrassi, The Next Generation, Life with Derek, and Overruled. He's currently got two seasons under his belt of writing and being the supervising producer for CTV's Motive, which flips the whodunit on its head by starting each episode telling you who done it. We talk about his jobs producing, writing, a childhood of Dungeons & Dragons, and his plans to milk artisanal goats in my conversation with Matt McLennan. So it sounds like from your Twitter feed you've been through a bit of a week, which includes, and the fact that you're talking to me a couple days later, includes being hit by a car.
Yeah, it sounds bad, but that's why I always like to lead out with, I'm fine, but I got hit by a car. Yeah, it was a weird week. I got hit by a car and hit with a cold, which was great in a lot of ways, because there's always that people say like, oh man, I got a cold. Feels like I get hit by a truck. They're totally different. Like when you do them back to back, you're like, this is nothing like each other.
Exactly. How's the car? That's what
the
I
cold remember. Was worse.
Is the car okay?
Oh no, I took out his mirror, poor guy.
Wow.
But like really nice couple, like 10 out of 10 would be hit by them again. They stopped. One of them was a doctor. They were like, are you okay? Instead of like trying to back over the guy who was biking.
Did you give them a good Yelp rating?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend getting hit by these people. They're just good people.
Well, that's good. Where were you when you got hit?
I was biking down a road wearing a ridiculous, like a skeleton jersey and skeleton gloves with two flashing lights on my bike.
There's like foreboding and, happening right there. You realize that?
Yeah, it's Halloween. But I'm like, somehow I got not seen. So maybe not the best driver. So I got sideswiped into another car and bounced around a bit. It's pretty interesting.
I think possibly being on a bicycling and then wearing that kind of outfit could possibly be somehow that's got to tie into a Motive script somewhere.
I've always wanted to do a scene where people like roll up with the scenes where they have like motorbikes roll up and like
pull
up koozies and stuff. I've always wanted to do one of those, but. I try to think about it with cycling, and it would just look dorky. You'd be like, hang on a second. You have to pull out your Uzi from your backpack with your helmet on, and it just, I don't know.
Ring the bell.
Yeah, like, give me your money. I don't know, it'd be weird. Trick or treat.
Have the basket on the front.
Yeah. Put all the money in the basket. Put it in my strawberry shortcake basket.
It puts the lotion in the basket. So, Motive this year, now if I'm to believe IMDb, which I don't often, but this year on Motive, in addition to doing some writing, you are also the supervising producer?
Yeah, it was the same thing I did last year, yeah.
Okay. So tell me, what is the difference between a supervising producer and every other producer?
So producer credits are weird because there's nothing that really governs them. as you may or may not know,
I've just seen about 18 different producers. I think everybody sees that. You know, everyone who watches a television show, and the credits are getting the opening role credits are getting worse now because
it's ridiculous.
You're in the 17th minute and you see a producer credit go by.
Like, wait a second, there's another assistant producer. It's like 23. There's been two commercial breaks.
I'm in Act 3.
Yeah, is this a joke? Yeah, no, it's So the thing is, like, you can't really judge what someone's doing based on their credit. You have to kind of dig a little bit because there's also, I mean, it, like, people will get a credit and not actually be doing producer type jobs,
right? So I mean, they're money producers as well as creative producers.
Yeah, like EPs. Yeah, some of them are like money EPs. Some of them are more have a hand in the creative stuff. Some of them are creators of the show or the showrunner. They do stuff. Usually. Some are EPs only a name, I find. And then when you get down to the producing stuff, like co-producer, producer, line producer, supervising producer. So line producer ends up, like, you know, doing a lot of the achieving. How do we make the budget match what we're trying to achieve with the project and sort of time and money management, stuff like that.
Yeah.
If you're a writer-producer, you basically have to recognize that once you're done a script and you're very happy as a writer, you have to take that hat off and put it in your office and then put your other hat on, which is to realize that you're producing the script. And so you have to take 60 pages of basically, I like to think of it as like a hassle. Like I'm like, you go to some really nice people who are very talented in their own departments and you deliver a hassle for the night. This is like the shit you have to worry about for the next week. Like
right.
These props, these sets, these stuff like that. And then you have to try and work together as a team to figure out how to achieve these things. And like what's most important and what's least important and what we can lose and what we need to keep and stuff like that. I really enjoy it. Like it's a real fun process, and understanding how the other side of it works, I think, is really important. So that, because some writers who are just like, you know, like they just want to write, and then when someone says you can't have the submarine with the rockets with the dolphin army, they're like, V counters, how could they, why don't you tell me how to write? It's like, you know what our budget is, dude. Like, why would you write a spaceship? Like, I don't. Like, it's they're not bad people. You're just being unreasonable. Like,
as soon as I heard that reference, I immediately thought back to Life of Brian with Monty Python and the spaceship scene in the middle of the film.
I grew up on that.
Which is one of the most bizarre, surreal scenes of all time. One of my favorite film scenes of all time.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. So basically, let's say creative side producer, without specifying supervising producer, as it being a creative side producer, I'm assuming it allows you kind of that helicopter view of the entire season even before the writers come in.
Yeah, I mean,
or like is it at the same time?
Well, the writing room sort of gets together long before anything else, and we're all integrated together and figure out, like, you know, that's my writing role, still the same as any other show where you come in and you try to figure out the season and what we're going to do with characters and what stories we're going to do and stuff like that. And then the difference is if you're producing, it's like when your scripts get into production, that's when your other role starts up.
Right. So what are some of the things that you've been excited about with regards to over the past couple seasons and some of the, especially with the thing that I like even about shows that are considered procedurals these days is I don't think you can do a show anymore that doesn't have character arc and a longer term story arc to it. It just seems like maybe it's been the push of more cable shows or just the fact that people can have PVRs and DVRs. But it always seems like there is some kind of arc. Is that something that, you know, you relish as a writer and as a producer to be able to tell that kind of long form story, or it's somewhere in the back of your mind, do you wish that there was still a Law and Order kind of mentality out there where you never really heard anything about the characters outside of what was going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're spot on by saying, like, by attributing it to sort of cable, leading that charge. And I think a lot of, networks are looking at the success of cable series and sort of saying, well, hey, this is like they're drawing a big audience. What's this about? And some of them are heavily serialized. And personally, like I, you know, story is really interesting because, you know, for me, it's like, does your scene work? Does your act work? Does your script work? Does your episode work? Does the episode work within the context of the season? Those are all different like puzzle pieces you can look at. And so I really enjoy season arc stuff and integrating that. And the challenge right now is with network shows is like, how much of that are you really looking for? And often they don't really know, like they're trying to figure it out. I think it's a really cool time because network television is changing. Like it's not, you know, television you can fold your laundry to. You're engaged with the characters and it's not like, you know, not to, you know, shit on Law and Order or anything. Those are great, successful, amazing shows, but I'd like the fact that we're moving past this, you can tune at any time and just sort of get it. Shows
well, and that's and that still has to be a little bit of a barrier, though. Is if you're putting a script together, in as much as you would love to have some revelatory moment for one of the major characters in their ongoing story arc, you also have to realize that as soon as that moment, you know, hits the fans, that may forever change their perspective on the character.
Yeah, and it's a gamble too, right?
Yeah.
Like because, you know, sometimes they don't want characters to change and they can really push back. And that's happened to a lot of people on shows where some of the tenets of the show, like the person is, they change a character and suddenly like the audience just like flies off the handle. And it's like you, like they've been cheated on or something. Like, how dare you
right.
make this person different than they were, you know, it's not right.
With a show like Modern that has a kind of a very constructed premise to it, like when you go into the show, you know, this is the basic format of how the show is going to be laid out to you. Have you always viewed that as, okay, this is great, this is going to be a challenge, or do you find it restricting sometimes when you sit down to write an episode?
It scared the shit out of me honestly, like it did. Like I watched the show and I was like, wait a second, the killer and the victim off the top, and the cops usually get the bad guy on most network shows. So, like, I don't really, and I started watching it and I got intrigued by it. And it was really interesting. But then when you sit down, you're trying to actually think of a script, like all the stuff you're accustomed to, like these whodunit act breaks and the kind of the audience not knowing what you know, which is who the victim and killer is, it's gone, right? So you're kind of like, oh shit, like you just, what do I have to work with here? And my take on it when I rolled in, and I talked about this with Dennis, who's an awesome showrunner and a great writer and a pal. I sort of said, like, I need to have something going on in the present, like beyond just the puzzles of how do you connect the dots between these two people? So in last season, we made a real effort to have some present day stakes going on. So it's like, yeah, we're going to figure out the connecting the dots between the killer and the victim, but there's also going to be like a girl who's kidnapped, and what are we going to do about that? And things like that are sort of real time threats that keep the plot active while you're also working on the puzzle of it all. It's a real challenge though. Like it's a brain buster when you try to break some of the episodes, because you're thinking about the story in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And then you have, like, on top of that, there's flashbacks and the killer's point of view in this present day story or her present day story, and, you know, and so there's just a lot to keep in your mind. And thank God we have like such a super smart room. And we're all like, it's funny, 'cause when we have conversations, like every room's different, right? But like the social culture, but our room is funny, 'cause we'll be like, oh man, he thought of a great kill. Like, yeah. we don't talk about, you know, oh, this poor victim or this great case. It's like, wouldn't it be awesome if, like, we get excited about murder? Like, out of context, it's not a good conversation to be having, but it's great. And then we get into the, you know, really into the character of it all, and the actors that we have to work with, like Kristen Aluia and Brennan, are just like phenomenal. And so, and they're really good about finding those little character moments, even in a scene that's, you know, primarily driven by exposition or something like that.
Well, when you have an example like that, when you come up with a great kill, let's say, is there the one or two people in the room that are responsible for, or are the go-tos for saying, oh no, this show just did that two seasons ago, or that other show did that two seasons ago, or does it end up devolving into one of those situations where it's like, oh, you know, one person comes up with something and then someone else says, you can't do that. It's almost like a stand-up comedy joke. Someone already did it.
Yeah, that's a constant problem now in writing television, because people, like the audiences, consume so many hours of narrative, right? And then, you know, on top of that, they're also studying it. Like there's, like, you know, Wikipedia and TV Tropes and all these sort of and fan sites and boards and stuff like that that pick it apart. So, but I think I think you do a disservice if you just say, oh, that was done on a show, and so we can't do it. It has, for me, it's got like the litmus test is like, is it fresh? Like,
yeah,
you know, so a murder is not a fresh concept on television. So if you're going to get really nitpicky about it, we shouldn't write anything anymore because basically everything's been done, which I don't tend to believe in, because I think the whole fun of storytelling now is in the texture of it. So in that, in the motive room, we, well, you know, if the kill is very similar to something we've done recently, or even in seasons past, somebody will say, like, this is similar. Do we care?
Right.
Is it too similar? Is it going to be a downer for the audience if they've seen the other episode? And usually if it is too similar, we nix it, and try to come up with something else. But the more I do this, the less I realize I know about writing in a good way.
Right,
and
sure.
I try to follow the things that people get excited about. Like if the motive room, if those, like, people get excited about a kill, it's going to be good. Like, I just have faith in that.
Right.
And so you have to follow that a little bit. You have to follow your gut, your emotionality, or whatever about it.
Do you sometimes wish, as you're throwing an episode together, that you know, if it were only like 30 or 40 years ago, I would have an extra 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Like I would have 52 minutes instead of 40 or 41 minutes.
There's this T.S. Eliot quote I read a long time ago in school, and it basically said that if I'm going to paraphrase T.S. Eliot really poorly right now. If creativity is basically unfettered and has nothing to bounce against, it tends to sprawl and I think make for a bad product. Right. If you put arbitrary boundaries on it, people get pissed off and they rebel against it.
Right.
And that's when they find some new cool stuff that you would never find otherwise. And so, yeah, I mean, it would be totally different if we had 10 more minutes. I don't know what that would do to the show. And it'd be different if it was a 30-minute show. Like, I don't know how they'd do that. But it'd be interesting to sort of see what that looks like and how it makes things change.
I think it's almost why you see shows that have, you know, that go into like 6, 7, 8 seasons. All of a sudden you'll have episodes that are considered maybe goofy. Like, you know, here's the musical episode.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, because someone said you could never do this, we're going to do it kind of thing.
Yeah, or wouldn't it be crazy if, like, that's the other spectrum where it's like, this is so insane, I'm going to pitch it, you know, and dare you guys kind of dare you to make it, which are great. Like, those episodes are awesome if you don't, you know, blow your show off the rails with, you know, ruining your whole setup world and stuff like that. But that's another sort of mode of, like, you know, just a petulant, childlike, I'm going to do it anyway, kind of, which is a cool attitude sometimes to have. Like if you're careful about it and you play it properly.
Have you settled into the concept of that you're almost? It almost looks like with Canadian shows right now that you're living in a 13 episode universe.
Yeah, it seems that way. Although I do hear talk about people looking at the BBC six pack.
13 episodes seems to be the longer runs now.
Yeah. Sometimes they'll be 10 or 12, which is interesting because it's certainly not the 26, you know, the first show I worked on, we did 26 episodes a season, and it was like, that was crazy when you think about it, because you think about how drained you get after 13, and then, some of the other, like, we've in the 80s and stuff, when they had I can't imagine that. No wonder why everybody was super high on coke all the time. It's like, I don't know how else you do all that work. Like, it's just crazy making.
Well, yeah, back in the 70s, I mean, the standard was 26 episodes, and you can understand why procedurals were procedurals at that time, because you almost had to be cookie cutter. I mean, the shooting schedules had to be insanely quick.
Yeah, that probably is. Yeah, I'd agree. Yeah.
So before coming to Modifer the past couple seasons, looks like kind of 4 or 5 years of hitting up a bunch of Canadian television shows. And it seems like with almost every writer that I talk about, producer that I talk about, showrunner that I talk about, that seems to be almost the Canadian way. That you have this stretch of about 4 or 5 years before the show that I'm talking about, which most oftentimes I'm talking with somebody who has been on a show for 1 or 2 years and it's a show that's kind of caught on. But there's... in everybody's resume, everybody's IMDb, it seems like there's this stretch of like, oh yeah, that Canadian show and that Canadian show and that Canadian show. Is that something that you've kind of taken the history of that and said, you know, that was a great thing for me because I got to visit so many of these shows? Or was there something limiting not being able to have opportunities because you had to jump from show to show to show?
It's you know, when you're like, I've done a pretty big volume of work, which I'm super grateful for. I was doing this application for a thing this year, and I was like, holy shit, I've been doing nothing but work,
right.
Which is, you know, in this country is very difficult, and I'm very grateful for. And the downside, though, is that you don't get a lot of time to be working on other stuff, taking a break and working on pilots and doing your own thing. And you know, there's a part of the mentality when you're writing is because it's freelance, it's like make hay while the sun shines, right? Like,
right.
So it's like if there's a job, you don't want to turn it down because you're worried you may never eat again.
Right.
And then this has happened with a couple of friends of mine who've had some bad years. Like, and then I feel bad about complaining about how tired I am from working. So I don't, because it's an asshole thing to do. But then now they're kind of, I was chatting with a friend the other day and he's like, man, I hate to say it, but like, I'm so busy. I feel bad that I, you know, like, and I feel bad about feeling bad. But it's part of the thing. Like, I think you have to be committed to working pretty hard if you're going to grind out being a TV writer in Canada. There's just not a lot of spots, and we don't do a lot of programming, and so you've got to be really committed to it, I think.
And kind of, you know, ensconced in a few of the police and drama shows that you've done, you had quite a few episodes of Call Me Fitz as well. How was that experience for you in terms of writing comedy versus writing drama?
I've done both. I've had, like, this is kind of the cool thing about the Canadian market is, unlike the US, you don't have to really say, this is my genre and here's what I'm going to do,
right,
as much. They don't expect that of you. So I've been able to bounce around from comedy to drama, from film to TV, like even did a video game in there. And that's all been really cool because you get to experience sort of both sides of it. And I don't find them that different in terms of story. Fitz was, Sherry Elwood made an incredible show, and Heaton was on that as well. And, a lot of great writers. But the heart of that show was, Priestley's character was Fitz, and the comedy came from the character. That was the big edict on that show. And I think likewise, the drama has to come from character. Like, if there's an event that happens in a story, whether it's comedy or drama, and it's just, you know, anyone could have had that happen to them and it would have been interesting, then it's probably not a good solid story point. Like, yeah. if it's a joke that anyone can crack, it's a gag, which sure is cool. Like, gags have their place, but it's not character driven stuff.
Yeah. Another is everything endemic to the talent that we have, basically. You know, if you could take the same plot and drop it in any other show, then how unique is it to our show?
Exactly. Exactly. Totally.
Yeah. Have you found that we talked a bit earlier about the idea of how the fans are watching more and more and more television these days and piling up the hours? Has fan engagement, whether it's been online or through any other capacity, how do you think has it changed the way that writing is done for shows?
I think it has because people, there's this, okay, so when you're a TV writer, you know, like a million plus people will watch an episode of Motive that I wrote, right? Mm-hmm. I don't shake their hand. I don't watch them watch the episode. I have no interaction with them. I assume they have a good time, and don't hate the show. There's this distance between you and your audience. And so, and I thrive on like connection. So it's this weird thing where it's like, I get to connect with like a million people. But I don't actually, see any of them. And then so suddenly it's like, oh no, there's Twitter and there's forums and there's all this stuff, and you can you know, once in a while I've done like live tweeting during episodes of different things, and it's pretty cool. But inevitably a fan will ask a question that you're like, oh shit, like you're, or get mad about something, and you're like, shit, like there's a downside to this as well. So I think because you're at this distance, there's this temptation to like, oh, I could get the juice that I'm looking for, like the interaction with these people who are mysterious and watch my stuff. But at the same time, it could be a real curveball for your writing, because I think it was Hart Hansen, I don't want to misquote, but his point was that on Bones, that the people who you hear from are not necessarily your core fans. They're a very small group of people who are very, very loud.
Yes.
And so if you tune into that too much, you're opening the door to criticism. And that's really not necessarily the mode that you should be in. Sometimes you have to just go create and hope that it's good and take that gamble. And if you're second guessing yourself the whole time, you're just not going to come up with anything fresh. So it can really screw you up as well.
It's funny because everybody thinks back to almost the legend that used to be the Star Trek fan back in the 70s and 80s, and how,
yeah,
you know, they used to completely nerd out on every single little detail, and
yeah,
you know, but it seems what the web has afforded us is the ability to have that level of fan for almost every show. Almost every show that's out there that has a following, there is going to be at least a handful of them who are that deep into it. And I'm sure they know more about the show than any single writer on the show.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, I remember there were people in the Rookie Blue, when I was on Rookie Blue, there were people that would stalk, like, not stalk, sorry, that's a bad word. But they would stand outside the office and the studio, like, for the whole day. Like, and they were fans, and it was like, you know, that doesn't often happen in Canadian TV. And granted, Rookie's a very special show, too.
Sure.
But yeah, there's some, you know, I was thinking about that the other day. I was with a buddy, and we went to one of the 1,000 comic book movies that are coming out. And he was a comic book guy, and we played Dungeons and Dragons together. Like, sure. We were basement dwelling nerds. Like, yep. And now, you know, he used to get his ass kicked, and I used to get my ass kicked, and, you know, made fun of and shit like that because of what we loved. And now there's this thing where, like, the geeks are mad because we're like, man, I put in time. Because you had to. Like, if you wanted, like you're saying in the 70s, like, if you wanted to be that guy, you had to watch every episode of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And then cross-reference all the things they were talking about with, like, you know, the library. And, like, and so it took, it required this depth of knowledge, right? And so now people can just acquire that knowledge, not with any depth, which is the difference, I think, but they can acquire it very quickly. Like, if you want to become a, I see this with my nephew, who's like 13. If he wants to learn about anything, he just goes and, you know, give him a day or two and he's got it all down, right? So you could just, like, right now I could, you know, probably download or buy on DVD, like, every episode of Star Trek and just watch them back to back, and then sure. I could be as competent as that guy in the 70s. But there's less love involved in that, I think. Like, maybe that's just because I'm older, but...
Well, there's something about watching something to be entertained and watching something to a level of... I don't even want to say obsession, that's not it, but to where you've invested yourself, you know, beyond, because, I mean, like, probably, and I don't even know this for sure, I'm guessing somewhere out there, someone's created a wiki for Motive and put down wiki notes for every single episode with hyperlinks to every single time that this secondary character appeared and created a character profile for the secondary character and listed every single thing that they've ever done or every meal that they've ever had. And, like, that's some, like, deep level stuff that when you're writing, you can't imagine someone's going to be thinking this. Like, I mean, if you were writing a novel which was taking you 15 years to write, then maybe you would think to yourself, okay, I'm going this deep on this, someone might go this deep on this, but you don't have that luxury to go that deep when you're writing an episode.
A lot of times we wouldn't have the time to. Yeah. But I the thing is for me about folks like that is, like, I am sort of a magnet to passion. Like, if someone is excited about something and, like, super engaged in it, I don't really even care what that thing is.
Sure.
I want to talk to that person and just get to what's at the heart of that joy for them. Cause I think that's so interesting. So I'll talk to, like, someone who's into stamps for like, and not in a, I'm making fun of you, I'm bored of you kind of way, not to mock them, but to be like, you're really fucking into stamps. Yeah. Like, you have a chubby for stamps. Like, that's like, how does that work? Like, what's that about? Like, I met an insurance adjuster who was really passionate about her work once, and I was like, well, tell me about that, you know? But I do think that any human pursuit that has that level of gusto behind it usually means that the person is, you know, it's what they've chosen to put that juice into, and that there's something that drives them towards that, and I find that interesting. And so I never judge them, even when they call me out for making mistakes. I try to be like, you know, this matters to you. Like, I remember when I was working on this video game project, I misnamed a weapon because I hadn't done my research, and there was a guy who was fucking pissed about it, because it was like, he was like, you have, and he didn't even talk to me. He talked to, like, his supervisor, who had to, like, come find me, and he's like, hey, do you have a minute? And I was like, sure, man, what's up? And he was like, listen, I have a team member who's really concerned about these rockets on this level. And I was like, oh shit, like, what did I do? And he's like, there's surface to surface missiles that are on the back of that truck, and you've got them firing in a helicopter and bringing it down, and you know, the guy's really mad about it. And I was like, it's just a mistake. Like, I'm sorry. I'll fix it. Like, no problem. But it was like, I guess maybe someone expected me to like dig my heels and be like, no, like I know they're fifth, but I'm like, no, it's just I made a mistake. I'm sorry, I'll fix it. But and I like knowing that someone on the team cared about the project that much that they got that distressed about it. Like that's apathy is the thing that I hate. Like that's when you know you're screwed. Like when you hand something to somebody, like yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
you did okay. Like, there's no engagement. And, like, I honestly would rather have someone be like, oh, my God, what a piece of shit. How could you hand me this script?
Right.
Because then there's a conversation to have. Like, then there's, like, a, wow, you got really pissed off about it. Like, what's that about? Like, where does that lead? And I think that stuff's interesting.
I think even with the podcasts that I listen to, some of the bands that I go to see, especially with podcasts, I would rather listen to somebody who gives a shit about what they're talking about and not caring about what they're talking about. To me, it's all about the energy and the level of dedication that they have towards actually talking about it. And I don't care whether they're talking about, you know, cereal or talking about toast, you know?
Yeah.
You know, whatever they talk about, as long as they're passionate about it. I remember back, when was it, about 10 years ago now, when American Chopper first came out, that family who was...
I
got sucked into that show. I don't know a thing about Choppers. I don't care about Choppers.
Yeah.
But this entire family for like two seasons was like invested in this and like coming to blows over the fact whether they have this kind of fender on it or this kind of fender on it or this. And it was just like, holy shit, these people, they are so invested in this. It could be anything. They could be talking about toasters. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think part of it too is like it's similarly to the knowledge, like we have this access to this great breadth of knowledge, but you don't get that depth that I was talking about. I think the same thing happens with how humans are interacting with each other. Like, you know, like having a good conversation is so unique and cool now because you talk to people less.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's why I like stuff like podcasts because it's like, it's kind of going back to like the radio shows of the 50s and stuff like that, or 40s and 30s. But I think people are looking for experiences and they're looking for authenticity. That's the big thing right now. And so it's, and they're in this artificial world where we're kind of all, you know, leaving messages for each other on walls and stuff, which is a weird way of communicating. We've all decided to do. I think when you encounter someone who is real and interesting and engaged and it's just everybody, I don't know, you kind of get into it because you're like, wow, you're a real person who's really into this experience. That's cool. Like, let's talk about that.
I think it's time where we need to cool off a bit with our beverage update. It's always a natural segue point to have the beverage update. And I don't have the most, I'll go first. I don't have the most exciting thing that I'm drinking right now. So I will talk about maybe something I'm going to drink later. I'm a bourbon collector. For anybody who's listened to the podcast before and knows that I mostly bring up bourbons. One of the ones I got recently was a very popular brand, which is Maker's Mark, but they actually have a new label out called Cask Strength, which means they don't blend it to get it down to a certain percentage or a certain proof. They just pour it right out of the cask. So the cask strength that it will change, and it's actually handwritten right on the bottle. So the particular one that I have is 113.2 proof, which is 56.6%.
So that'll get the job done.
Yes, it will. So I will be I'll be enjoying a couple of sips of that later tonight. Being, by the way, we're recording this on Halloween night.
Happy Halloween.
Yes, indeed. So you know, I figure if I drink enough of it, I will see ghosts everywhere. That's my plan.
I was just going to say, you should talk. You ever talked to Dennis Heaton about bourbon? He's a big fan.
I have talked. Actually, one of the first episodes we did was with Dennis.
Oh, cool.
And that was like, seriously, it was either episode number one or two going way, way back. And of this form of the podcast. And I don't know if we talked about bourbon then or not. I can't remember. I'd have to go back and check. But yeah, so. I'm running into more and more bourbon. Whenever I bring up bourbon, invariably every one or two episodes, someone's going, oh, yeah, I like bourbon too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So what is your beverage update?
Okay, this is going to sound so pretentious.
Pretentious is good.
Well, something about, because it's coffee-based pretension, bothers me because coffee is a simple drink. But I broke my coffee maker, so I bought another one. I'm on the road, as I have been for the last 15 years. And so I bought this Japanese cold brew coffee maker. So I'm that guy now, apparently. I'm obviously having problems with this. I've only had it for 2 days. So I'm drinking a glass of that, which is delicious and hyper-caffeinated. And the coffee maker is only $20. So if you want to be a pretentious douche about coffee, there you go. It costs you $20.
Do you put anything in the coffee?
Cream and stevia.
Okay. So like there's no – is the cream like some artisanally churned –
No, no, I didn't hand milk the goat, or I probably should. That'll be the next time I talk to you, it'll be like, yeah, I've got my goat milk in my.
It's like, oh no, stevia. No, we don't do that. I put a drop of honey that they gathered from a Burmese bee.
Yeah, I just waved the idea of sugar over top of it, and then just when I smell hope, that's when I know it's time to drink. It's like so crazy.
The smell of hope.
Yeah, it's just coffee. It's good coffee. Is all I'm saying.
Where did you get started in your career? Did it go all the way back to high school or college, university, or anywhere else that you just kind of said writing is going to be it for me?
I mean, like I could go way back. I think it all started when my mom, who's a teacher, was teaching my brother how to read, and I got jealous, so I was like, I could do that, and then. And so I learned how to read earlier than most folks. And so, I was in a library the other day and I was like, wow, this is it felt like a really powerful place when I was a kid. Cause you could go in and I was like, I can literally learn anything. And it was crazy. So that's where it all sort of started. And then I started writing. I used to read the Hardy Boys and stuff when I was a kid. I'd read anything.
Good old
and
then
I
started, Franklin W. Dixon.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And then I'd start typing on my dad's typewriter and make, like, you know, but these are stories that people who aren't writers tell too. So,
did you make up fanfic about Chet and his jalopy?
Yeah, pretty much. Like it was some shitty story about a haunted house or I don't know. And, you know, and I think it was probably a Scooby-Doo Hardy Boys hybrid. And then I was thinking about it the other day. I watched like a shit ton of TV when I was younger. Like it was like all I did.
Well, we can actually like kind of pre-jump. Normally, I wait till the end of the episode to start asking about pop cultural touchstones. But I mean, we can jump into that right now because I'm always up for some retro television talk.
Listen, I was like the chunky monkey little kid who like I was nervous and shy. I still have like I'm still not good socially sometimes. So I would just binge watch everything, and then when I wasn't doing that, I was playing video games or playing Dungeons and Dragons. So like. Almost my whole, looking back at it now, my whole world was just like really insular little place. And it was all about story, which is kind of cool. But I used to, like, you name it, man. I used to watch it like.
So were you growing up watching in this mostly the 70s or 80s?
I was watching a lot of stuff in the 80s, but there was a cool thing then was like, I don't know if you remember, but A&E came out around,
sure.
I forget when, but they started running old shows, and that's when I watched like, and I used to binge watch that shit. They had like it was like a 3 hour thing every day, and I used to watch it all. It's or not every day, once a week or something like that. But it was like Banachek, Columbo.
Yes.
Who else was it? What was the art guy? I can't remember his name. Anyway, like all those like 70s sleuth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boiled detective.
Well, they used. I mean, yeah. So they used to the Columbo, McCloud, McMillan, and
McCloud,
Wife.
Yeah, yeah. McMillan and Wife. Yeah. Banachek, that's what I was thinking.
Banachek's a great pull there because George Peppard, before the A-Team, before anybody really focused on him.
Yeah.
Banachek, the what was he? I think he was Polish, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I think he had like an art. He's super charming. Like, just, yeah. And I love, like, there's such a funny era for heroes on cop shows because they were just so, like, I don't know, they had a lot of character and a lot of, you know.
Well, they did, and you often had the Jim Rockford, you know, idea.
Right, that, yeah.
Rockford got the crap kicked out of him every single episode.
Which is awesome. Like,
yeah.
This is the coolest. He's like underdog.
He'd always be ready to get into a fight, and then he'd get the crap kicked out of him.
Didn't he live in like a shitty trailer, too?
Oh, did he live there, or was that just his office?
I forget. Maybe
he drove
office,
the crappy car, and yeah.
But it was like anti-aspirational
yes.
heroes, right? And same thing with Columbo. Like, he drove a really shitty car,
yeah.
Chomping on a wet cigar. And he actually looked kind of – like, he made himself look stupid to solve cases, which yes. is like – I don't know how I'd pitch that to a network now. I'd be like, so what's this, what's the edge? Like, what's the different spin on the procedural? I'm like, a mod detective seems pretty dumb, but really he's smart.
Well, yeah, but it's funny because I would even argue that that still happens to in a twisted way, in that what we have now are a lot of these kind of alter cop heroes who all have, you know, the gift of some sort. And a lot of the male ones, especially, like, I'm thinking going back about 15 years to Monk, let's say,
yeah,
who, you know, had this special ability but was socially a disaster.
Right.
And, you know, even you know, Hart Hanstrom had Backstrom came out, which was the Ryan Wilson show, which, again, yeah, same kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's how that's the new spin on it, as opposed to in the 70s, you just had the schlubby detectives.
Yeah, like, now they've got to be, like, broken. Like, yes. And I think that's like a Sopranos kind of, you know, when you could have a hero who was a shitty human being on a lot of levels. And then House, too, I think changed the landscape of TV as well. Like, it's like, I'm a doctor who hates patients. Yes. And I was like, I want to see you talk to a patient. Like, yeah. I want to see you. And, you know, and then Hugh Laurie, and the writing on that show was so good. And then so it's become this sort of wave that's happening in narrative, which is interesting because that happens. I was watching this old movie the other day from like the 80s. I forget why. And it was like a kind of a ripoff of like Fatal Attraction, but there was this whole little genre, or maybe it was 90s. There's a whole little genre of like, I slept with a girl and I'm married and now she's going to kill me.
Right.
And people didn't realize it, but they're just, it's this wave that just happens in narrative. I think that's kind of interesting. So I'm always trying to figure out what the next thing is. And then I'm also trying to forget all that and just write.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
Whatever fascinates me.
So did you end up going through school for writing specifically, or was it for something else and you just kind of kept writing as a sideline all the way through?
Well, I mean, so yeah, so in high school I was like the dude in the bomber jacket chain smoking.
Yeah.
Because I was cool writing poetry. I had a ponytail. I was that guy. my process was like, I love writing, but I wasn't very good at it, I thought. And I'd show stuff to people and it wouldn't go over well. But I loved it. Like, it was what I loved to do.
Sure.
But I was afraid of it. And all the more so when I'd bring stuff out to people and they'd be like, yeah, this sucks. And I'd be like, I'm a failure. I'm awful. Why would I do this? So the process after high school for me, and high school was weird for me too on a lot of levels, was basically coming to admit the fact that I wanted to do this. Yeah. And I had a girlfriend at the time. She's since passed away. And one of the greatest gifts she ever gave me was, I mean, it was a shitty relationship, but she kicked my ass into going into writing. She was like, you know, basically said, like, she's like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to be a writer. I was like, well, why aren't you not doing it?
Right.
And I had no excuses. And she's like, why don't you just get off your ass and go commit and make it happen? And I was like, well, yeah, why? I don't know why I don't. I go, okay, fine, I'll do it. So then I went to Concordia University because they had a creative writing program.
Right.
There was only two in the country at this time. And so I went there, and that was a phenomenal place to learn how to write. I lucked, I mean, with any writing thing, it comes down to the teachers you get and the writers you're with. And I lucked out. I had a really great peers and really phenomenal professors there as well. But my intention was to be a poet because that's awesome. And
because if there's anything where there's a viable market out there, totally, more than being a TV writer.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make the billions of sweet poetry dollars.
Yes.
Want to be
up for prizes every year that nobody's heard of.
Totally, yeah. And I wanted to be a prose writer. And then I kept writing these short stories. And my prof was like, these are really great. They're called plays. And I was like, what are you I don't write plays. What are you talking about? He's like, they're all dialogue. They're all character. And that those are plays. Like, why don't you? And so I, on top of taking my poetry and my prose stuff, I started taking play writing, and that's where I met a phenomenal dude by the name of Michel Choquette, and he also taught a screenwriting course. So then I took that, and that's when I was like, oh, this is like, this feels right. This feels good, yeah. And this is like what I can maybe do this. And so he taught me a shit ton about story, and he was a very like, he was unforgiving, and I don't mean that in a mean way. It was like, if your shit wasn't done, he was like, well, then you'd be fired. Like, you don't not deliver on a deadline.
Right.
That's just not. And if your stuff sucked, he'd tell you. Like, and you know, and if if there were ground rules, like your story point had to fit on a 3x5 cue card and you had three of them stapled together, you'd be like, that's not, you need to boil it down some more, you know. So yeah, so that's where I kind of learned. And then after that, I moved to Toronto, trying to get into, because I knew that there was, I was in Montreal at Concordia, so I knew there was no real market for an English-speaking writer there. So I tried to get into theater and stuff in Toronto as well, but it didn't work out. And then I got my first job.
Just kind of slugging away year after year.
Oh yeah, it was a grind. When I wasn't writing, like I would get these little jobs where you're writing like a feature for some guy who's scraped together a little bit of money. I remember like going to buy, I was an office PA, so, and my girlfriend at the time was an actress and she was in theater school. And so I remember we would go to buy groceries and she would go grab the groceries and I would sit in the car and try to write more of this feature that I was working on. And then I would come in and like grab the groceries with her and then I would come home and I would write some more and then I would pass out for, you know, 6 hours and I would go to work. And it was like, you know, I'd write on coffee breaks and stuff just to try to, and then and networking, I got like kind of obsessive about, I sent out like probably thousands of emails.
Right.
Like I stole email lists from the DGC and shit. Like, I was emailing people I had no business emailing. And I look back at it later and I was like, dude, you emailed like Jeremy Padeshwar. Like what were you? You just thought you should do. And he was like, he sent me a nice email back. Yeah, it was just sort of like, my whole thing with that was like, be fully committed to it. And if it doesn't work out, then you can move on and you can leave it knowing that you gave it a fair shake.
Right.
And it's not obviously your thing. So now you can forget that and move on to something else. And so that I fully committed to it to the point of like financial ruin almost. Like I was paying my rent with my credit cards and right. stuff, which I do not recommend.
No. Paying off one credit card with a cash advance on another credit card.
That's it. Yeah. Oh, okay. New credit card. You can transfer. Great. Cool. So I can eat for another month. Awesome. And then you know, like it always happens, this years of effort turns into like this lucky break, and a person who introduced me to a person introduced me to a person, and that was Derek Schreier, and he was looking for a script coordinator, and that was my first TV gig, which is ironically back in Montreal. So I ended up moving back there. So,
and then once you kind of make that break, that's where you kind of get in the club, so to speak.
Well, I have this theory that as soon as someone thinks that they've arrived, I don't know how to describe
it. I wouldn't say arrived. I'm just saying at least you make the connections and you get that level of trust, right? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like it does help, but I think what I was going to say is that I think it's wise to never think that you've arrived. So when I got my first job, I was like, cool, this is great. I better capitalize on this and get an agent and meet new people and try to, you know, find the next thing to jump onto because, I can't depend on this to be like, people aren't just going to find me. And so I just kept at it with the same sort of level of obsession. And I think that helps. And then it weirdly turning from one project to another to another to another, and it's been like I'm writing my 40th episode of TV, I realized the other day, which is crazy to me. And I've worked on something like 15 shows, which is also crazy to me. And I only realized this because I was doing my resume the other day and stuff like that. But yeah, it's been phenomenal. But I think the real thing is just the hustle of it. Like you just have to meet whoever you can meet, and that's the only way to kind of do it.
To kind of bring it back around, and I always like the framing device, so to frame it back with Motive a little bit.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the CTV ABC scenario that went on with Motive over the past year or so.
Those are conversations that are kind of above my head.
Yeah.
I don't know a ton about it, to be honest. I have my little patch that I have to do, and that's I try not to tune into any of that stuff on a show because I find it ruins my focus a bit.
Sure.
I just come in and I do try to make a really great script, try to prep and produce it, and then I honestly try to ignore the market quite a bit, which I know a lot of people don't agree with, but I think you can get really down about stuff and you can
What I was thinking about as I was asking that is there, as a writer, are you having to think a little bit different because the show's you got a show that's going to be shown in the States versus a show that's just going to be shown in Canada?
Yeah, you always have to be conscious of your audience, right?
Right.
So there's stuff like, you know, culturally, you just have to make sure that it flies both ways. But Modo's not like we don't apologize about being Canadian. Like, we don't have to be like, oh, here, look, is American money, and oh, we're in a fictive place only because of clearances and stuff like that. It's way easier to write stuff in Metro versus, you know, like Vancouver. But they're proud of the city, and they show it off, and I love that about it. It's great. Like, it's a celebration of what's out here. And I've grown quite fond of Vancouver after being here for this is the second show I've done out here, but I've lived here maybe like 3 years of my life,
yeah,
all told. So it's kind of cool for that reason. I think it's interesting.
So is there anything on the horizon that we should be looking for?
I have no idea. I used to freak out at the end of every show because I'm about 2 months out now before I got a split. And I used to flip out about it, and I probably will in a couple months. But right now I'm in this place of like, I'm writing my last script for this season. So I'm trying to really just, you know, do a great job on that and make it mean something to me and stuff like that. And it's a little milestone in my career of like 40 episodes of TV. So I'm kind of focused on the here and now. And then, you know, I don't know. Like, I have no idea what the future is going to bring. And I want to work on my own material and see where that kind of goes. And then see what happens in the industry and see what's available next year. Because there's a lot of cool shows that are kicking around, and I'm curious to see how they all pan out.
Do you watch shows now with a view to, even whether it's Canadian or American shows, with a view to saying, geez, I'd really love to write an episode for that show?
Anytime I watch a show that I get enamored with, yeah, for sure, I think. And sometimes it frightens me. Like House of Cards, I'd be like, I'd love to write one of those, and holy shit, that would, like, I'd fill my shorts. Like, that'd be so intimidating to do. Like, Mr. Robot, I really liked a lot, too.
That was a great show.
Yeah, like, I thought, what a cool way to do Hackers. Like,
because
it's not about the, you know, the typing code onto the green screen and, like, execute. It's about the, I don't know if you've seen the whole show, but, like,
yeah,
I think
Yeah,
and the pilot, he just comes in and says, hey, like, I just owned you. And it sort of explains what owning means, right? Yeah. Rather than just a term, it's like, I got into your life. I know everything about you. I know all the bad things that you don't want anybody to know. And now I'm going to do whatever I want with them. And it was like, wow, like, that's, you know, that's a cool. So I'd love to write for that show. And like Christian Slater, I just dug on him as an actor. So.
Well, that's the thing. They found a way to use him because he was typecast in so many ways after, you know, after his early career and, you know, trying to find the right way to use him. And I think they found a way in this show that is just like fantastic.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And I got excited about him, like pumping the volume days. Like,
oh yeah. Heathers was fantastic.
Yeah. Right. Heathers. Yeah. So yeah, like, and then there's, you know, there's stuff here that would be awesome to write on too. Like, there's a lot of cool, a lot of cool, promising shows and shows that are doing that are interesting stuff. Like, I think Camp X is really cool.
Yeah.
I think like Killjoys is such a cool, interesting world. Orphan Black, obviously, is like such a cool thing to work on. And I, you know, people get down on Canadian TV, and fuck those people. I like, there's a lot of cool stuff that we're doing here, and I think the cool thing that's happening too is like, the export market is growing. Like, you know, Mr. D just, like, you guys did a post on that, but Mr. D just sold his format, right?
Yeah.
And I think more and more the market of television is getting a lot more global. And that's cool for Canadian TV folks because that means we have reach and that people are actually like, you know, thanks to things like Orphan Black, not that it's the first export show, but like it's prominent. So suddenly people are like, oh, maybe Canadians can write some TV. And then they do.
Thanks to Matt McLennan for joining me on another episode of TV ABCs. This is a podcast which intersperses with our regular other weekly podcasts about Canadian television news. You can come back here and check out our long-form discussions every other week. If you go to the website tv-eh.com, look up at the top, see podcasts. You can find all of the podcasts that we do there. You can find TVA on Twitter at TV_EH and find our Patreon page, which is where if you want to, on a value-for-value model, you can kick us a buck an episode or maybe even more, help the air conditioning in the summer, the heating in the winter, the server farms, which we have chugging away to try and bring you the best podcast content. and the best web content we can on Canadian television. Help us by going there, and if you want to, you know, just share the love with a couple of bucks. That's patreon.com/TV_EH, patreon.com/TV_EH. You can find all of the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Again, thanks to Matt McLennan. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.